Chapter 10. Sharp made it to the corner of 3rd and 23rd with time to spare. He leapt out of the patrol unit and ran over to the phone, carrying the bag with the money in his hand. They weren't taking any chances. The bag really contained $10 million in neatly packaged large bills. Sharp felt nervous carrying all that money. Once again, he tucked his sidearm, a 10mm polymer ceramic semi-auto tucked into a shoulder holster. He also carried a small 9mm squeeze-cocking backup piece strapped in an ankle holster, a commando knife in a spring-loaded sheath topped strapped to his forearm, and a tiny 380 semi-automatic, small enough to fit in the palm of his hand, tucked into his shorts at the crotch, where he felt reasonably confident it would escape a frisk. He glanced at his watch, 30 seconds to go. He took out the telephone adapter and held it ready. When the phone rang, he picked it up on the first ring, quickly slipping in the synthesizer adapter into place over the receiver.
"Steel,"
he said.
"Good,"
said Tommy B.
"You're right on time. Let's see if you can keep it that way. Corner 4th and 8th. 5 minutes." Click.
Sharp ran quickly to the car and leapt inside. He laid at rubber as he peeled out, heading south on 3rd Avenue down to 14th Street. He was heading deep into no man's land. As he drove, he left the civilized part of the city behind him and headed into the darkness. There were no streetlights down here. The high beams of his armored patrol unit cut through the darkness, illuminating shabby-looking people who scurried back into the shadows as he passed. He reached 14th Street and turned right, heading west down 8th Avenue, the unit careening around the craters in the street, lights flashing off the ruined buildings. He could see the fires burning in many of them, the only illumination and the only source of heat for the desperate people living down here. All too often, these old buildings caught fire, and no fire department ever came to put out the flames. Sometimes the residents managed to put out the fires themselves. More often than not, the buildings simply burned, and then, when the flames had finally gone out, if anything was left, the people moved back into the blackened ruins, preferring a charred environment they knew to an abandoned building that could conceal unknown terrors far greater than the flames. The car screeched around the corner of 14th and 8th, and he pulled over to the curb. There was no telephone booth in sight. He didn't know why he should have expected one. There was no phone service in no man's land. There were no services of any kind except those provided by the gangs. He sat in his unit, the engine rumbling, wondering how contact would be made. He took out his pistol, thumbed the safety down, and held it in his lap. Nervously, he rolled down the window. He almost jumped when he heard a voice say, "Avenue D in Houston, move it. You got 3 minutes." He heard the sound of running footsteps and realized that someone had crept up to the side of his vehicle while he was pulled over. His heart was pounding. Whoever it was could have just as easily have lobbed a grenade in through his window. He didn't waste any time. The car shot off down 8th Avenue and he turned off on Greenwich, heading down towards 6th, once known as the Avenue of the Americas. He opened it up all the way, flying over the buckled, cratered street. He turned left on Houston and headed east, across the island to Avenue D down by the East River. He glanced at his watch, cutting it close. The time was almost up. He made it to Avenue D and pulled over to the side. There wasn't a sound except the loud idling of his engine. The streets were completely deserted. It was like a ghost town. He glanced at his watch. He was late. Shit! Shit! Something hit the side of the car. He snatched up his pistol and waited for the sound of the explosion, but it didn't come. He took a deep breath and cautiously opened the door. A brick was lying in the street beside his car with a note wrapped around it. He quickly picked it up, closed the door, and read the note. "Corner of 1st and 34th, it said. Phone in the corner. 4 minutes.
"Christ!"
said Sharp, wrenching the shift lever into gear and peeling out, heading north on Avenue D back up to 14th. Bordini was running him around in circles.
"That's okay, Tommy,"
Sharp said to himself as he fought the wheel.
"Keep it up, you son of a bitch. Just keep it up. I've got all night."
For an ordinary man, the swim would have been an extremely exhausting one. But for Steel, it was no more difficult than doing easy laps in a pool, which he had done in training to get accustomed to how his nigh steel prosthetics performed in water. They performed well enough to break every existing swimming record. His powerful nigh steel legs propelled him through the water as if he were a dolphin. He was well into the harbor before he encountered the first of the mines, but he had no difficulty in avoiding them. They were firmly anchored to the bed of the harbor, floating a few feet above the surface, aimed at taking up boats, not frogmen. With his bionic optics, Steel had no difficulty seeing in the water, and he swam easily between the moorings of the mines. In the distance, his amplified hearing picked up the sound of a patrol boat's engines, and he angled out away from it, heading in toward shore. The boat did not change course, not surprising, since it would have run into the underwater mines if it had. Steel smiled around his mouthpiece. The very mines that were meant to protect the harbor from intruders were now protecting him. He was using rebreather tanks that no telltale bubbles so that no telltale bubbles would appear on the surface, giving him away. But he doubted that the patrol boats would expect one man to try swimming underwater the length of the entire harbor, which is about 3 miles from the tip of the center aisle to its southernmost end, only to face the formidable security on the grounds of the estate. This would be the easy part. The hard part would come when he came ashore. Before long, the upward slope sloping bottom alerted him that he was getting close to shore, and he cautiously broke the surface of the water, looking all around him. The mansion was about 300 yards off to his right, on a gently sloping rise over the harbor. He could see the docks about 150 feet over off to his right. One of the patrol boats was tied up here, and several men, all armed with automatic assault rifles, were gathered around it on the dock. He heard their laughter as they killed some time together smoking cigarettes. He scrambled up out of the water and plunged into some undergrowth near the water's edge, where he stripped off his wetsuit and tanks and hid them in the bushes. He opened up the waterproof pouch, took out his fatigues and boots, and quickly put them on. Then he strapped on the belt containing his accessory hands. He took out his father's old .45 Colt and tucked it into his waistband at the small of his back. He slipped the commando knife into its sheath, and he started moving through the trees, heading uphill and toward the mansion. He heard the dog a second before it sensed his presence. Even as it tensed, prepared to bark, the barrel of his dart launcher slid out through the port in his hand and fired. The dart whistled through the air and struck the animal, its poisoned tip killing it instantly. The second dart struck the guard in the chest before he even had time to react. Steele retracted the dart launcher and ran out quickly, staying low, and grabbed the body of the dog with one hand and the guard with the other and dragged them back into the trees. He could see the shore batteries halfway up the hill between the docks and the mansion, but he wasn't going to worry about those now. It was the automated defense systems he was concerned about, especially the surface-to-air missiles. The attack would have no chance of succeeding unless he could neutralize those, and for that, he had to get inside the mansion. The power lines from the plant to the village ran down to the main terminal in the basement, where, according to Raven, the auxiliary generators were also located. She said they'd had a blackout once, and the generators had kicked in automatically within 60 seconds. He'd have to put them out of commission. That would leave the people in the control room unable to activate the defense systems, and the missiles would be useless, but the only way into the basement was through the first floor of the mansion. There was a large side entrance to the west, at the east wing on the first floor that led to a lounge area for the guards, just off the kitchen. That was where the video display monitors for the security cameras were. Raven said the guards held poker games and hardly ever paid attention to them. He sincerely hoped so. A hallway off the lounge led into the mansion, and the door to the basement stairs off that hallway. If he could cut the power line from outside, that would leave him 60 seconds to get there through the guard room and past any guards who were in there, down the hallway, through the door, to the basement, and to the auxiliary generators. There was not a lot of time. Steele hoped that they were standing by on the broadcast link. "Higgins," he thought. "Are you there?" He heard Higgins' voice inside his mind. "I'm here, Steele. Where are you?" "I'm on the grounds of the estate," he said, then realized that he had spoken out loud. Higgins heard him just the same. "How does it look?" "So far, so good," Steele said, still speaking out loud but very softly. It seemed somehow more comfortable that way. "I've had to kill one guard so far, but I haven't set off any alarms. I've got to get in close to the mansion and cut the power lines. That'll leave me exactly 1 minute to get inside and knock out the auxiliary generators before they kick in. I'll let you know the minute I've got the lines out. Then stand by to give the signal for the chopper to move in. With any luck, you'll get in about 1 minute. If you don't hear from me within 5 minutes after I go in, that'll mean I blew it."
"Okay, we'll stand by for your signal." Steele grimaced. It felt decidedly uncomfortable to have Higgins in his head, but he had to admit that, this time at any rate, it was certainly convenient. He wondered if Higgins had spent any time tiptoeing through his mind when he wasn't aware of it. He recalled the time he'd asked Susan Carmody about the backup copy of his program that he knew they had on file somewhere in their databanks. It was a conversation he was not likely to forget. In fact, unless something went wrong with his cybernetic brain, he would never forget anything again, ever again. He could recall the entire conversation word for word.
"Where is that file, Susan? You know where it is. You can get access to it."
"No, I couldn't."
"I want you to erase it for me."
"I can't."
"Why? You think it would be murder?"
You don't understand. If anything should happen to you, it would be the only thing that could."
"Something did happen to me, Susan. I should have died. But thanks to that implant in my brain, you made yourself a backup copy of my soul, programmed it into a machine. Nobody's got the right to do that."
"Steele, don't."
"I could find a way to live with what I am, or whatever the hell that is. I don't want to keep coming back again and again, just to keep your little experiment going. The next time I die, I want it to be for keeps."
"But you didn't die."
"The way I was, I wouldn't call it living. And I'm not sure the way I am is either."
"You don't understand. Don't you see? It would make no difference. Even if I could do as you ask, it would be discovered almost immediately. And Higgins could simply pull in another dated engram copy directly from you."
"Not if I can help it."
"You wouldn't even know it."
That was how he had discovered what he had already suspected. That they could tap into his mind, access it through the broadcast link just like they could access a computer program. Which was exactly what he was. He wondered what would happen if he bought it on this mission. Would Higgins find himself another vegetable in some hospital somewhere? Someone whose brain had been irreparably damaged so that they could have him declared legally dead and keep his body on life support while they took out his organic brain and implanted a cybernetic one into his skull to be programmed with a backup copy of the Steel program? Would he suddenly wake up in a brand new body with no memory of his death? The thought of this dormant alternate self residing somewhere in his project databanks was something that haunted Steele, something that frightened him almost as much as the electronic ghosts lurking somewhere in his program. He had not told Higgins, Gates, or Dev Cooper about them, but he wondered if they knew just the same. If they knew, if they could read his mind, why hadn't they said or done anything about it? Were they simply waiting to see what would happen? Or was there a limit to what they could read in his mental engrams? Steele pushed the thought aside. Now was not the time to agonize over those dilemmas. After this was over, there'd be plenty of time to try and sort things out somehow. And if he did not survive the next few minutes, then perhaps the problems would be over. Perhaps. On the other hand, perhaps not. He watched the two of the guards coming up from the docks and circling around the back of the house, heading toward the side entrance where their lounge was. He took careful note of the path they followed. Intelligence had indicated that the sections of the grounds around the estate were mined, and Raven had confirmed this, but she had also come up with a piece of useful information that Intelligence didn't have on file. There were pieces of slate set into the lawn at intervals of about 2 feet, running in parallel about 3 yards apart, forming a walkway that effectively indicated the proper paths to take it in order to avoid the areas that were mined. There were no children at the estate, and the dogs did not run loose, but there had been one occasion, Raven said, when an inebriated guest had wandered out into the backyard and blown himself to kingdom come. It had put a considerable damper on the party. Consequently, Victor Borodini had ordered that the mines be set back farther from the house, beyond a waist-high hedgerow so that guests could walk in safety anywhere inside that landscape perimeter. Beyond that, if anyone wanted to go down to the shore or to the docks, it was necessary to keep to the paths. Raven had not known how many mines there were or where they had been placed, and if from where Steele watched it into concealment, he could not see the paths. Judging by where the guards were walking, he would have to cover some 25 to 30 yards before he could reach them, and it was all well-lighted, open ground. He also noted that as the guards were coming up from the docks approach to the house, two relief guards came out of the lounge and started heading down to meet them. That meant they were working shifts, and one of the shifts was changing, which meant that it would not be long before the guard he'd killed would be discovered missing. He didn't have much time. He reached down to his belt and unsnapped one of his accessory hands from its locking disc. It did not resemble a hand at all. It looked more like a short, nice steel tube the same diameter as his wrist, fashioned in matte black, about 4 inches long, with six short turrets of various diameters extending from it in a circle like the barrels of a miniature Gatling gun. It would fit either on his right or left wrist, and in the center between the turrets was a port through which he could fire his built-in dart launcher or the 10mm. It contained a built-in miniaturized Geiger counter, a voltmeter with the test cables retracted inside one of the small turrets, and a metal detector, all of which fed their readouts directly into his brain. He tucked the appendage underneath his left arm, then released the lock on his left hand and snapped it in place on the belt. He took the Swiss Army knife, as he thought of it, in his right hand and snapped it in place onto his left wrist. It locked in with a soft click. About 30 yards of well-lighted open ground to cover before he reached the hedgerow that marked the edge of the minefield, and then he had another space of open ground to cover before he reached the house. He'd have to keep his eyes out for the guards and hope that no one would spot him on the monitors and from the back windows of the mansion. The barrel of the 10mm pistol built into his forearm slid out of the gun port on its right hand. He clicked it into the silencer attached to his belt, then held up his left hand with the turret attachments. It whirred slowly as it revolved around, clicking the adjustable wrench into position. He put it over the silencer, and it tightened down, then revolved quickly like a power screwdriver, screwing the silencer into place. The guards heading back toward the house had now reached the side entrance. The ones heading down toward the docks were down below him now. Farther down the slope, if they didn't turn around and glance behind them, and if no one saw him on the monitors through the windows of the mansion, and if none of the other guards came out, especially the ones with the dogs, Steele took a deep breath and crouched down low, holding his left arm out before him. Well, here goes nothing, he thought, and started out across the lawn. The phone was already ringing when Sharp reached it. He snatched up the receiver. Hello? He said breathlessly.
Who the hell is this?
Sharp froze in his anxiety to get to the phone. He had forgotten to slip the adapter over the receiver. Thinking fast, he quickly slipped the adapter into place and held it well away from his mouth, saying loudly,
"Get away from that phone!"
Then he held the phone up to his ear and said,
"Borodini!"
Who the hell was that? What's going on?
Just some guy standing on the street. Picked up the phone before I could get to it.
Silence.
Borodini!
Yeah, I'm here. Okay, take the Midtown Tunnel to the island. Follow the expressway out to the Meadowbrook Pathway. Head south to the Coliseum. I'm giving you a half an hour to make it, so don't waste any time. You'll be watched at points along the way. You don't know, you won't know where. If anyone's on your tail, the hostages are dead. Understand?
I understand,
said Sharp.
I'll be alone.
You better be.
What do I do when I reach the Colosseum?
Drive your car inside through the service bays and park in the center of the arena. Be sure to bring the money.
Borodini hung up the phone. Well, this was it, thought Sharp as he headed back toward the car. The Nassau Colosseum would be the last stop, the perfect place for an ambush. Still had less than half an hour left to pull off the assault on the Enclave and get Victor Borodini. As he pulled away from the curb, he reached for the handset.
Bagman to HQ.
HQ here. Go ahead, Bagman.
I'm headed north on Thirst Avenue to the Midtown Tunnel, then taking the Long Island Expressway to the Meadowbrook Parkway and south to the Nassau Coliseum. It's going to go down there. I've got half an hour to make it. Any instructions?
Proceed as directed, Bagman. Keep us advised.
Roger. Bagman out.
Proceed as directed. That meant the assault had not gone down yet. He bit his lower lip. Come on, Steel, he thought desperately. We're running out of time. Steel moved quickly across the lawn, keeping low, running in serpentine around the buried mines. With his detector feeding the information directly onto his brain, he could move much faster than a man working an ordinary metal detector, and he could keep his eyes out for the guards. His cybernetic brain analyzed coming data far more quickly than a human brain could. It gave him reaction time far greater than that of an ordinary man. So he was able to sprint across the minefield, instantly changing direction to avoid the mines like a superhuman broken field runner. Okay. So far, no alarm. He was halfway to the hedgerow when the two guards appeared from around the other side of the house, 75 yards away. One of them had a Doberman on a leash. He was completely out in the open, and they couldn't avoid seeing him. He saw the dog's ears pick up as he switched on his laser designator, his eyes lighting up with two bright red pinpoints as he brought his right hand up. The silenced pistol coughed softly as he fired three shots in rapid succession. The flat trajectory of the high-velocity 10mm jacketed hollow point gave him the range to make all three shots count. The first one hit the dog, dropping it in its tracks before it could start barking. The second and third struck the two guards, both headshots, killing them instantly. Steel quickly looked over his shoulder towards the docks. The other two guards hadn't heard. They were still walking with their backs to him, talking to each other, oblivious to what had happened behind them. Steel was thankful they didn't have a dog. No alarm came from the mansion, but there was no way to get over to where the two guards and their dog had fallen and drag their bodies out of sight. They would be exposed now and sure to be discovered within moments. He wasted no time in zigzagging through the minefield and reaching the hedgerow. He vaulted it and sprinted toward the side entrance of the house. As he ran, he retracted his 10mm gun barrel back into his forearm and pulled out the silenced Colt. In the close confines of the guard lounge, he wanted the close-range knockdown power of the slower bullet without risk of overpenetration that could result in a slug going through a wall and alerting someone on the other side or needlessly injuring any of the household staff. As he rounded the corner of the mansion, he ran right into a guard coming around from the front, heading toward the side entrance to the lounge. As the startled man gaped in amazement, Steel quickly raised his turret attachment and shot him with the dart. The man crumpled to the ground without a sound. Steel quickly found the junction box where the power lines entered the house. The turret attachment on his left wrist revolved in a soft whirring sound and clicked into position. Another soft, brief whine with the miniature servo motor and the wire cutter extended from the turret. Steel tucked the .45 into his waistband, ripped open the cover of the box, reached in with the cutter, and snipped the lines. There was a brief sparking and all the lights inside the mansion went out, simultaneously with the floodlights illuminating the grounds.
Okay, Higgins, I'm going in. Time!
60 seconds. The clock was running. Steel switched in his thermal imaging system and ran for the side entrance. He could hear the guards inside, reacting to the sudden blackout. He threw open the door, drawing his Colt as he burst through into the darkened lounge. In a flash of perception, he could make out the thermal images of 9 guards around the lounge, 5 of them sitting at a table, 1 by the coffee maker, another one standing by the refrigerator, 2 sitting in front of a television set. No one had been watching the video monitors. The two in the front of the security, suddenly dark TV, were already on their feet and turning. The one by the refrigerator stood with his hand on the open door, the man by the coffee maker turning around, the two men around the table rising to their feet. Firing simultaneously with his dart launcher and the silenced Colt, Steel dropped the two in front of the TV and the one by the refrigerator. A quick shift of aim with his left arm, and the one by the coffee maker fell, all before any of the guards had time to react to his presence in their midst. And then their reaction time caught up to him.
Jesus, what the hell? Look out, son of a bitch!
Steel brought the Colt around and shot the two men who had risen from their chairs. Two of the others at the table were rising and reaching for their sidearms. The Colt coughed twice more and they were hurled back over their chairs, a bullet through the center of each of their foreheads. The fifth man had thrown himself out of his chair and was rushing for the door leading to the hallway. Just as he reached it, Steel dropped him with a shot through the base of his spine. He heard footsteps quickly running up the stairs to the side entrance from the yard and spun around. The Colt fired twice and dropped two guards as they came running through the door, leaving the pistol empty. Steel tucked it in his waistband and ran through the door into the darkened hallway. 20 seconds had elapsed. He switched from the thermal imaging to night vision as he ran down the hallway looking for the door leading to the basement stairs. According to Raven, it was on his left, about 15 to 20 feet down the hall. He could hear someone shouting from somewhere in the house.
What the hell happened to the power?
He reached the door without encountering anyone in the hallway and wrenched it open.
Relax.
Someone responded.
The generator will kick in a minute. They probably blew a fuse or something down at the plant. I can't see a goddamn thing.
Steele hurried down the stairs. 25 seconds. He made it to the basement and quickly looked around. Raven had never been down here before, and she didn't know exactly where the auxiliary generators were. It was a large basement, unfinished and mostly open. Numerous storage crates were piled up all around. Steele spotted the large boiler and the water heaters. Where the hell were the generators? 30 seconds. He ran to the wall beneath the guard lounge, where the power lines from the junction box outside should have been routed. He had to thread his way through piles of crates to get there. He had no idea what was in them. Arms, perhaps, or drugs. Maybe even stored food. The Borodinis were into everything. 35 seconds. He could hear running footsteps on the floor above him. They'd either discover the dead guards already, or would in seconds. 40 seconds. There they were. He ran over to them and bent down to start disabling the motors. 50 seconds. One was out. Now for the other. 53 seconds. Come on, come on! 57. Got it! From upstairs, he heard a shout, sounding muffled through the floor.
Christ, we've been hit!
Higgins! Steele said. I've cut the power! Go! Okay, we're coming in. Get Borodini.
Holy shit, where the hell's the power? What happened to the fucking generators?
We got intruder! Sound the alarm!
What alarm? The fucking power's out!
They must have got the generators.
Someone's in the basement.
Come on, move, move!
Steele heard footsteps coming down the stairs. Sharp was driving at top speed down the Long Island Expressway, punishing the suspension as the armored unit hurtled over the cracked and buckled highway roadway. Weeds grew through fissures in the highway. The road was totally deserted. There was not a sign of life. He passed Lake Success, just across the border from the Queens in Nassau County. County lines had long since ceased to mean anything except as references for geographic location. There was no government out here except for that provided by the enclaves. The towns and villages were mostly deserted, falling into ruin, with only outlaws, derelicts, and screamers struggling for survival in total desolation. The surviving residents had long since gone to the enclaves for protection. Most of Long Island was a vast, deserted no man's land, slowly reverting to wilderness, and Sharp was on his own, heading at top speed straight into an ambush that waited for him at the Coliseum. He was now less than 2 miles from the turnoff for the Meadowbrook Parkway, which ran south all the way down to Jones Beach. Once he made the turnoff for the parkway, it was only a few miles to the Nassau Coliseum, located just outside the deserted town of Hampstead. Once a sports arena, in the years immediately following the Bio War, stories had it that the Coliseum had been used as an arena for much more savage games, staged by outlaw gangs that roamed the island, preying on survivors until the enclaves had been formed. Sharp had no idea what, if anything, it was used for now, but he was certain of at least one thing. Today, it would be used as a killing ground. Lookouts posted on the nearby abandoned dormitory towers of what had once been Hofstra University would be able to see for miles in all directions and give warning in plenty of time if any backup units started coming in by ground or chopper. Sharp knew that if he reached the Coliseum and went in there before the enclave could be secured and Borodini captured, chances were he would not come out again. He was speeding to his death, and there was nothing he could do about it. He took the turnoff for the parkway and started heading south. His heart raced. He felt sweat running down his back as the vehicle careened down the deserted parkway.
HQ to Bagman. HQ to Bagman. Come in.
Sharp grabbed for the handset.
Bagman here. Go ahead, HQ.
The fox is in the henhouse. Repeat. The fox is in the henhouse. Proceed as directed and stand by.
Roger, HQ. Bagman out.
Steele was inside and the assault was in progress. Sharp felt adrenaline hammer through his system.
Go, Steele.
He said through gritted teeth.
Go, go, go.
Steele quickly released the lock on his turret attachment, popped it off, and reattached it to his belt. He bent his elbow back and rammed the stump of his wrist into the polymer ceramic 4.7mm machine pistol attachment on his belt and twisted it free as it locked into place on his left wrist. It gave his left forearm the appearance of having a flat back 2x4, slightly over a foot long, sprouting from his wrist. The trigger mechanism, safety, and select fire systems were all internal, slave to his cybernetic brain the moment the pistol attachment was in place. The select fire system gave him the options of semi-automatic, 3-round burst, or full auto. A 50-round magazine was snapped in place along the top of the barrel with a second barrel offset underneath the first, aligned with the dart launcher built into his left forearm. The bullets in the magazine were fed into the chamber by means of a gas-operated cylindrical bolt that rotated 90 degrees to align the cartridge with the barrel, a system that was simple and highly reliable. With no rearward bolt travel, the cycling system was extremely brief, allowing a high rate of fire, up to 2,000 rounds per minute. The caseless ammunition was only a fraction of the size of a conventional cartridge, square in cross-section, reducing the friction in the magazine and affording maximum use of space. The fully combustible cartridge meant that there were no brass to be ejected, and the projectile was propelled at 3,000 feet per second. Polymer ceramic construction eliminated the need for maintenance and cleaning, as well as doing away with overheating. It was a scaled-down version of the Strike Force battle rifle, designed to function as a part of him, completely thought-controlled. It could not jam, and slave to his computer brain, it could not miss. It didn't. He opened up a three-round burst as the men reached the foot of the stairs. The rate of fire was so quick that the three-round burst sounded like one shot. He fired four quick bursts, and the corpses tumbled to the floor. By then, he was already moving, having taken advantage of being able to see clearly in the dark. Two of the men in front had been carrying flashlights. One broke when they fell. The other hit the floor and rolled, its beam illuminating the bottoms of several crates. The men behind them on the stairs caught a brief glimpse of something moving towards them quickly, something with two red eyes that glowed like lasers in the dark. And then the machine pistol cracked out several bursts, and their bodies rolled to the bottom of the stairs. Steele swept up one of their 308 assault rifles as he rushed up the stairs, leaping over their bodies. Several men carrying weapons came running down the hall from both sides, some of the guards coming from the inside the mansion, others rushing in from the outside. There was a lot of shouting. Steele fired to his left and right simultaneously, several bursts from his machine pistol, an extended burst on full auto from the rifle, firing it one-handed and emptying the magazine. Their bodies dropped, piling into one another as the spent brass from the 308 pattered to the floor like hot metal raindrops. He dropped the empty rifle, ran to his left down the hall leading into the mansion, bending down over one of the bodies as he passed and retrieving its assault rifle. As he reached the end of the hall, he heard growling and the patter of paws on the floor behind him. He spun around as two dogs came hurtling down the hallway toward him. He dropped one in mid-leap with a dart and brought up his right arm, still holding the rifle, as the second dog struck him and fastened to his nice steel forearm. He pressed the pistol up to the dog's underbelly and fired a dart into it. The animal gave a brief whimper and dropped to the floor like a sack. Steele turned and ran through the darkened east wing of the mansion into its spatial entry hall. The large, wide flight of stairs leading to the second floor was to his right, the front entrance to his left. The stairway went halfway up to the second floor and then split off to the landing into two separate flights of stairs, leading up to the left and right. The front door flew open and several armed men came running in. Steele fired three short bursts with his machine pistol and dropped them in their tracks. Beyond them, through the front door, he could see three dogs running at full speed across the lawn. As they came flying up the front steps, he reached the front door, slammed it shut, and threw the bolt. An automatic weapon opened up beside him, and bullets peppered the front door beside him. He felt several of them impacting on his back. He raised the assault rifle and fired it one-handed. The gunman on the stairs dropped his weapon and rolled down the landing. Steele took the stairs three at a time. Sharp was doing well over 100 as he hit the turnoff for the Colosseum. According to his watch, he had only minutes before his allotted time ran out, both figuratively and literally. He glanced down at the radio, willing it to come to life and speak to him. Come on, Steele, he thought. Come on, damn it! If he didn't have Victor Bordini for a bargaining chip by the time he got there, he'd be on his own against Tommy B and his soldiers, and he didn't think much of his chances. The choppers came in low over Center Island, crossing Oyster Bay Harbor, across the spit of land separating Oyster Bay from Cold Spring Harbor. The jet-powered X-Wing with Ice and Raven in it was in the vanguard, well ahead of all the others.
Come on, man! Can't you make this crate go any faster?
Raven shouted to the pilot.
Keep your shirt on, miss.
The pilot said through his helmet speaker.
We'll be there in less than 30 seconds.
A man can die in less than 30 seconds,
she responded.
Then if you want to help him, you'll shut up,
said the pilot.
I'm going to have my hands full. Targets within range.
He came sweeping in low over the grounds in a wide arc, flying over the village and banking around it to line up with the security sentry towers on the wall surrounding it. The muzzle flash of automatic weapons fire erupted from the two towers as he came in toward them and fired two rockets. Both hit dead on target, and the towers exploded in twin fireballs as he hurtled through the wash of flame, angling the nose down and sweeping the grounds with his machine gun turrets. Mines exploded as bullets struck, and bodies flew into the air. As the guards below scattered, several of them panicked and ran into the minefields, tripping the detonators and blowing themselves up.
All right,
said Ice, grinning from ear to ear.
This is my kind of party.
Suddenly, the floodlights on the grounds came back on.
What the hell?
The pilot said.
I thought Steele took out the generators.
The chopper slowed, flying on rotor power now as they passed over the mansion's roof and saw men running out to the shore batteries covering the harbor, swinging them around and elevating the guns. The pilot fired a rocket, and one of the batteries went up in an explosion of flame. The men operating the other battery were desperately bringing it around and elevating it toward the chopper when he fired another rocket, and the gun emplacement went up in a ball of fire. All the lights were on inside the mansion. The surface-to-air missile batteries rose up from the lawn.
Jesus Christ!
The pilot said.
They're gonna fly right into it!
Even as he spoke, a couple of the missiles left the launchers, hurtling toward the incoming choppers. The pilot fired another rocket, taking out one of the batteries, then swung around to bring his aim to bear on another one.
Get us down there!
Raven shouted.
I can't,
the pilot said.
I've got to knock out those missiles.
There's too many of them,
Raven shouted.
You'll never get all of them in time.
I've got to try.
Two more missiles left their launchers. The pilot fired again.
Get down there, damn it,
Raven shouted.
Back off.
Ice pressed the barrel of his battle rifle up against the back of the pilot's helmet.
Lady said to get us down there,
Ice said.
Now.
Don't be a damn fool. You shoot me and we all die.
I don't gotta kill you, white bread,
Ice said, moving around and shifting the barrel of the gun. He pressed it down into the pilot's groin.
You ever considered being Jewish?
You're fucking crazy.
You got that right. Just set us down. The roof do fine.
All right, all right.
He hovered low over the rooftop and Raven leapt down out of the hatchway.
Thank you kindly,
I said with a grin, then turned and dropped down after her.
Crazy son of a bitch,
the pilot said, and as he raised up over the roof, he saw the first of the surface-to-air missiles strike the incoming choppers. As the lights came on all over the mansion, Steel froze at the top of the stairs. Fuck! There could only be one explanation. Something Raven hadn't told him. Something Raven hadn't known. The control room had its own auxiliary generator. Victor Borodini's paranoia had served him well. Borodini's quarters were down the hall to his left. The control room was at the far end of the hallway to his right. There was no time for Borodini now. The choppers would be coming in, heading right into a swarm of surface-to-air missiles. Steel sprinted down the hallway to his right. Someone fired at him from one of the rooms halfway down the hall. Steel didn't even pause. He kept right on running at full speed as the bullets whistled past him and slammed into his chest and shoulder. Steel fired the assault rifle, stitching the wall as he ran past the gunman, bullets tracking their way across the doorway and plowing through his chest. As the man fell into the room behind him, Steel didn't pause. His legs churned as he raced toward the door of the control room at the far end of the hall and slammed into it in full speed, bursting the steel-reinforced door off its hinges. The three men at the control panels looked up in shock as he opened up with both his machine pistol and the assault rifle on full auto, spraying the entire control room. The bodies of the three men sprayed blood and jerked like marionettes as the bullets struck them and smashed into the control panels and the radar monitors, sending out showers of sparks. Smoke billowed out from the control panels. Flames licked up from the consoles. Steel kept firing till both weapons were empty. Then he dropped the rifle to the floor, twisted the empty magazine out of his machine pistol, and snapped in a fresh one from his belt. The lights flickered, but stayed on. The generator was still supplying power, but the control panels smoked and sputtered, burning and shooting out sparks. The defense systems were now useless. The surface-to-air missile batteries had been disabled. Steel heard the crackle of a battle rifle behind him in the hall and spun around in time to see a gunman fall behind him. A moment later, Raven came down the stairs from the roof with Ice right behind her. He hurried to meet them.
Sweep across on full auto, right?
Said Raven with a grin. Right, said Steel. They heard the staccato beat of helicopter blades outside and above them, and there was the sound of automatic weapons fire as the assault units disembarked and engaged the remaining Enclave security personnel on the ground.
Where's Borodini?
Ice said. I don't know, said Steel. Down that way somewhere, I guess. They ran down the hall towards Borodini's quarters, Ice covering their backs. Steel reached the door and kicked it in. There was no one in the main room of the suite, but Steel's amplifying hearing picked up the sounds of breathing in the room beyond. Two people. In there, he said.
The bedroom,
Raven said.
Stand back,
said Ice. He fired a burst at the lock and kicked open the door. Polly Borodini sat up in the large canopy bed, eyes wide, naked, and holding the covers up against him, his long black hair cascading over his slender, pale shoulders. His father stood beside the bed, wearing nothing but a black silk dressing gown, bordered in gold and embroidered with his monogram over his breast. He held a black semi-automatic in his right hand. Steel, he said in an emotionless tone. I might have known. Raven caught her breath as she looked from Polly to Borodini with disbelief.
Polly? My God, Victor!
She said. The words simply failed her. The corner of Victor Borodini's mouth twitched slightly. Ravenna, he said. What a surprise. I had often wondered what became of you. And Ice, too. I knew I should have killed you from the start. Careless of me.
Drop the gun, Borodini!
Steel said. I don't think so, Borodini said. It's all over anyway, isn't it? And you've exposed my guilty secret. You may as well finish the job. He glanced toward the slender, long-haired boy sitting up in the bed. Dear Polly, he said, so much like his mother. Ugh.
Put the gun down, Borodini, Steel said. I'm not going to kill you. I need you alive.
Borodini glanced at him with a bemused expression. Do you indeed? Well, in that case, it will give me great pleasure to disappoint you. He raised the gun to his head, but before he could pull the trigger, Steele's lightning reflexes switched the machine pistol to semi-automatic mode and fired. The bullet struck the gun and set it flying. Bornini gasped with pain and clutched his wrist, wincing. He glanced up at Steele with venom in his eyes.
"Damn you to hell,"
he said through gritted teeth.
"Higgins," Steele said. "Get a hold of Sharp. Mission accomplished. The Enclave is secured. We've got Victor Bornini."
"Good work, Steele. I'm calling Sharp right now. Stand by." Polly slowly shook his head.
"I don't understand," he said softly. "It was a good plan. A good plan. What could have gone wrong?"
Sharp was out of time. He slowed as he approached the Coliseum and saw the service bays open, waiting to admit him. No word from Higgins. Damn it, he thought. He swallowed hard. There was nothing for it. He had to play for time. He'd have to go in and hope like hell he could bluff his way through. What could they have in there that could take out an armored strike force unit? Plenty, he thought. Rocket launchers would do the trick just fine. If he didn't get out of there with the money, they could just fry him where he sat. Riddle the unit with armor-piercing ammo until it looked like a Swiss cheese, and then simply come in and pick up the money. It might have a few holes shot through it, and some of it might be a little bloody, but what the hell? He slowly drove the unit through the service bay and on through into the arena. Maybe I can bluff them, he thought. Maybe I can buy some time. The radio came to life.
"Issue to Bagman. Issue to Bagman. The Enclave is secured. Repeat, the Enclave is secured. We've got Bordini. Acknowledge."
Sharp almost sobbed with relief.
"Roger, HQ. I'm at the rendezvous. About to make contact. I'm going to need some proof to convince them. And we're going to need it in a hurry."
"You'll have it. Stand by. We'll patch through to the Enclave."
Then Sharp heard Tommy B's voice from somewhere up in the seats above him.
"Okay, Steele. Into the line. It's payoff time. Get out of the car and bring the money."
"Okay, Sharp. We're patching you through. Stand by."
Sharp switched to his PA. He took off his helmet and spoke without the synthesizer disguising his voice.
"It isn't Steele, Tommy,"
he said, his amplified voice echoing throughout the arena.
"Steele's at the Enclave. It's been captured. Our agents have secured it. And we've got your father."
There was a brief silence.
"What is this?" Tommy shouted. "And who the hell are you? Where the fuck is Steele?"
"My name is Sharp, Central Intelligence. It's over, Tommy,"
Sharp said into the mic.
"While you were running me all over, thinking I was Steele, Steele attacked the Enclave with an assault unit and captured it. We have your father in custody. We'll make you a swap. Your old man for the hostages."
"You think I'm some kind of idiot?"
Tommy shouted.
"You expect me to fall for that shit? You're dead, you motherfucker. The fucking hostages are dead. You hear me?"
"You'll have to take my word for it, Tommy,"
Sharp said quickly.
"We're patching your father through. Listen for yourself."
Steele took the radio one of the agents had given him and held it up to Bordini.
"Talk to your son," he said.
Bordini smiled and shook his head.
"Do like the man say, Victor,"
I said,
"or I start having target practice with little Polly here."
Bordini stared at him. "You're bluffing," he said. I shot Polly in the shoulder. Polly cried out and fell back on the bed, clutching at his shoulder. Blood spread out, staining the sheets.
"All right, all right," cried Bordini, panic-stricken. "My God, don't! I'll do anything you say."
"Talk,"
said Ice. Steele held up the radio. Bordini's voice, patched in through Sharp's radio, came out over the unit's PA.
"Tommy, Tommy, it's your father. Do what they say. They've taken the Enclave. I'm their prisoner. Do whatever they tell you."
Tommy glanced at Rick.
It's gotta be a trick," he said. "I don't believe it. They could never take the Enclave. Never."
"It's Papa's voice," said Rick.
"Yeah, and it was Steele's voice I heard over the phone, only it wasn't Steele,"
Tommy said.
"It's a trick, I tell you."
"How do we know for sure?"
Tommy yelled down to the arena.
"I ain't falling for it, Sharp," he said. "It's a trick. You already tried that once with Steele's voice, and I ain't falling for it again. You hear me? You got 10 seconds to get out of that car with the money, asshole. 10 seconds! And if you brought the money, I just might let you live, if you're lucky. Otherwise, I'll blow you to fucking smithereens."
"He doesn't believe it," Sharp said tersely. "He thinks it's another trick, like with the synthesizer. Come up with something fast. I'm in a lot of trouble here."
"He doesn't believe it's you," said Steele. "Say something only you and he would know."
"Better make it good,"
said Ice.
"Or Polly be hurting."
"You people are barbarians," said Bordini. Steele stared at him and held up the radio.
"You said it yourself, Bordini. I'm not even human. I'm just a machine, right?"
He smiled grimly.
"No feelings, a robot, nothing but cold steel."
Bordini swallowed hard and moistened his lips.
"Tommy,"
he said, "Tommy, listen to me.
Remember what I told you when Caravelli blew up his hit on Steel?
Bordini's voice came over the radio and through the vehicle's PA.
Remember how I called you to my room and said you disappointed me? Remember how I was upset about the warrant and you didn't understand because you thought you were too strong for that to bother us? I told you that there's a lot more to running the family than simply being strong. You have to be smart as well. You have to know how to figure the odds and play the percentages. I told you that we had to think about the future. You remember, Tommy?
Rick Borodini watched his brother's face as the realization dawned on him that Sharp was telling them the truth.
It's him, Rick said. It's not a trick. It's Papa. That's what he always used to say.
Shut up!
Snapped Tommy.
We have to think about the future now, Tommy.
Victor Borodini continued.
We have to think about the family, about you and Rick and Polly.
Borodini glanced at his wounded son, pain written all over his face.
We've lost for now, but we can build it again. We can put it all back together, and we play it smart. And next time, we'll be ready for them. They've won this time, but it's not over. We'll come back stronger, and next time, they won't stop us. Not the Feds, not the Delanos, not the Pistorius or the Castellanos. Nobody. But we gotta play it smart, Tommy. We gotta know when to fold the cards. Do what they tell you, Tommy. This isn't a defeat. It's just a setback.
That's it, said Rick. They've got us by the short hairs. We're going to have to cut a deal.
No! Said Tommy, turning on him angrily. Fuck no! No deals! We've got the hostages. They do what we tell them. They do what I say. They play it my way, or I start sending them bodies.
And they start sending us pieces of Papa and Polly in plastic bags, said Rick. Don't think they won't. Those people ain't the cops. They're Feds. CIA. They don't have to answer to the city administration or public opinion. It's a standoff. We've got the hostages. They've got Papa and Polly. And we don't put things back. We can't put things back together without them or the rest of our people. We'll cut a deal straight across. We release half the hostages. They give us Papa and half the prisoners they took. We release the other half. They give up Polly and the others.
No! Shouted Tommy. No way! I ain't doing it! I ain't giving in to those bastards!
We have no choice, said Rick calmly. With the enclave gone, we've got a lousy hand. It's like Papa said, Tommy. You have to know when to fold the cards.
Forget it!
Tommy shouted, his eyes wild.
So they got the enclave! So they got the old man and Polly! So fucking what? We got our people in the city. We got the gangs. We still got our soldiers. We got the warehouses and our connections.
What are you talking about? Said Rick. Calm down, for Christ's sakes. Without Polly, we can't put the business back together, and you know it. Without Papa, we lose all our people, our soldiers, our connections, everything. You're talking crazy. Who's gonna run things? You?
Yeah, me! Why the hell not? You think I can't do it?
And what about our people at the Enclave? What about Papa and Polly?
Fuck them! Who the hell needs them? What's the old man ever done for me but run me down? What's he ever done for you but give you older orders like you're some kind of flunky? And as for Polly, he's just a fucking whip. He's useless. He's a zero. They want me to call their bluff. All right, I'm fucking calling. I'm gonna waste all their goddamn hostages, Sanderson and the rest of them, every fucking one. And I'm starting right now with that son of a bitch down there, that bastard.
No, you're not.
Get out of my way. I'm in charge. I'm gonna ice that son of a bitch right now.
Tommy, don't.
Tommy snatched up the rocket launcher.
Tommy. Hey, Sharp!
Screamed Tommy.
Kiss it goodbye, you son of a bitch!
A single shot cracked out, its echoes reverberating throughout the Colosseum.
Hold your fire!
Rick shouted to their men stationed in the stands around the arena.
Sharp!
Said Steele over the radio.
What's happening?
Sharp sat perfectly still, holding his breath and waiting for the flaming end, every single muscle in his body tense.
Mr. Sharp, can you hear me?
Sharp picked up the mic. His hand was shaking.
I hear you. This is Rick Borodini, Mr. Sharp. My brother and I have had a little disagreement. I'm afraid he's not going to be party to our negotiation. You can come out of the car now. No one's going to shoot. I'm coming down to meet you. Tell Steele that we can do some business.
End of chapter.